Welcome to the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR, where we talk to business leaders from around Ireland and share their advice on how to create the HR systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, simply visit www.insighthr.ie/podcast. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Okay, let's get started.
When the COVID-19 crisis hit our island last year, almost every business in Ireland was affected in some way. For some, it meant rolling out remote working in a very short period of time. For others, it meant layoffs and redundancies, while those deemed to provide an essential service had their own challenges to deal with. Today, we're going to talk about these frontline workers and specifically those in the not-for-profit sector. Many organisations in this sector are feeling somewhat squeezed as they work to continue to provide essential support and services, while at the same time, donations from traditional fundraising activities and donors have declined. Now, while the government announced an additional 10 million euro stability fund for the sector in February this year, it's still a very challenging time for the sector and its employees. I'm joined by Managing Director of Insight HR. Hello, Mary.
Hi, Sarah.
I'm also joined by special guest Tony Duffin, CEO of the Anna Liffey Drug Project, a national addiction service with a low threshold harm reduction ethos. Thanks for joining us, Tony.
Hi, Sarah.
Tony, perhaps you could kick things off by telling us a little bit about the work of the Anna Liffey Drug Project.
So you mentioned in the introduction that Anna Liffey is a low threshold harm reduction service, and that's not very obvious as to what that means to people. But what it does mean, when we say low threshold, we mean that the barriers of availing our services are kept as low as possible to keep people engaged with us. And when we talk about harm reduction, we mean that we seek to reduce the harm that drug use causes individuals, their families and communities. So we do a lot of work to with people who are actively using drugs and, keep engaged with them, keep them alive and well, and look for opportunities, positive opportunities for change. What does that mean in terms of, you know, services? What do we do? We provide sort of outreach work. We go out into the streets. When we're out there, we'll be engaging with people and linking people into services. We do a thing called needle and syringe programs, so people often refer to it as needle exchange. We make sure that people have drug paraphernalia to make sure that they're as safe as possible when they're using drugs. We provide medical services, so we have multiple nurses now. We have a clinical nurse manager and two other nurses, and they will do all sorts of nursing interventions. They work alongside the GPs that attend our services. We do a thing called case management, where we will look at a named worker for the service user. We'll look at the 12 areas of their life and set goals with them as they're ready to achieve those goals. And we do other things like we're not at the moment because of COVID, but we do prison inreach. We do work with people who are on probation and such. And we do interventions like community detox. So working with GPs to provide the psychosocial supports for people whilst the doctor is providing the medication. So there's some ideas about the kind of things we do.
So it sounds like you've really been maintaining these frontline services throughout the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's been quite challenging. I mean, given the public health guidelines and the need to reduce the spread of COVID-19 amongst drug users as well, how have you managed to adapt your services?
So we couldn't, there were certain things we couldn't do any longer because of COVID, because of the risk of spreading COVID amongst a very vulnerable group of people, but also when thinking about our staff. So we could no longer, we used to have a drop-in service, so we're a place where multiple people could just open access, come in. We couldn't do that anymore. Many of the people, all of the people we worked with were actively using drugs, so it was going to be difficult to maintain social distance and mask wearing and such. So we had to shut that down straight away. Last March, it had to end. We used to provide low threshold groups, so group work, and you know, you'd have 12 or so people coming in. Again, they may be under the influence whilst we're working with them. So it was going to be difficult to, again, to maintain social distance. And so those kind of things were things that had to stop. And I suppose some of the secondary work that we had always done, like outreach work, became our primary work because we could maintain safe distances. We could obviously work with people in a safe way. We were able to go in and during, when I look back on the beginning of COVID, we could go and work alongside other agencies, do inreach, making sure that obviously everybody was safe, but going into accommodation for homeless people and doing case management with them. And, you know, as I described before, and working towards goals with them. So there was lots of things we could do, particularly that example of working in accommodation, for example, with private emergency accommodation providers, that was in Dublin. We also work in Limerick, and in Limerick, what we found was we maintained our services, frontline services. We couldn't have people coming in, but we could do the outreach work. And the needle exchange program, which is fascinating to me, was three times busier in 2020 than it was in 2019 because there's just less pathways, there's less services open. So the services that were open, people really engaged with. So that was on the streets of Limerick. We saw many, many more people and engaged with many, many more people. So all those changes, it's really important for me to say, this isn't all about Analiffy. We work in partnership with a lot of agencies, and we can come back to this a bit, I think, around COVID and what things have been like. But we worked really closely with the HSE and the various councils, Dublin City Council and Limerick City Council and County Council, and other NGOs. There was some amazing work that has been done in the last 12 months by some NGOs. It's just been phenomenal, and it's been really hard work for people. It's been fascinating to be involved with and to observe just the level of dedication. Yeah.
So you mentioned a three times increase in the needle exchange service. Hmm. Has there been more of a demand placed on your other services as well?
We're involved with, we don't just do frontline services, we're involved with the kind of national policy side of things. We're through the government, there's a national drug strategy. And through my work with the National Voluntary Drug and Alcohol Sector, an umbrella group, I know from talking to them that that we have seen an increase in demand. We have seen the capacity amongst the NVDAS, particularly the residential beds, is down because of COVID, because you have to have fewer people in a room, you have to keep people apart, et cetera, et cetera. So the capacity has gone down, the demand has gone up, and that means waiting lists longer. And people are getting frustrated because it's difficult to get in touch with someone to offer them advice and guidance and such. But then when they do, the pathways are... it's not that they're not there, it's just that there's waiting lists now that weren't there before. I think people will understand why that is. It's just very frustrating for people. Yeah.
Mary, when it comes to the world of work, like, employers have this duty to protect the health, safety and welfare of their employees. And as we often talk about on this podcast and in our articles, this also includes their mental health and well-being. What kind of challenges have you been seeing employers facing in the not-for-profit sector when it comes to frontline workers?
I think there's probably lots of things to consider. I mean, you've got fear of, I guess, contracting coronavirus. And that, I think, has been right across all sectors during the pandemic, that people are afraid, and some more than others. And you know, employers have to take that into consideration. when dealing with people that you're asking to continue to work on the front line. And that has its challenges for employers. I think you also have had people who are delivering frontline services, you know, maybe becoming sick or having to self-isolate due to COVID. And that obviously affects the ability of the organization to deliver its services. And that can happen really suddenly. In an organization where, you know, that can be challenging from an employer perspective. And, you know, then there are health and safety concerns that employees have been raising with their employers around, you know, their conditions at work. And some organizations handle that better than others. But I think overall, it's probably not dissimilar to the kind of fear that any frontline worker has, whether that's working in a shop, an NGO, a hospital, a nursing home. I think there's a new element that has been introduced into our society that has changed, I guess, the way people operate, how we congregate. And in some cases, you can hear anecdotally from the employees, you know, a lot of the things that made being together in work pleasant can't happen anymore. You can't hug someone, you can't touch someone, you can't, you know, sit together in a large group. You can't go out together anymore. You know, a lot of those things are missing now. I don't know if you would agree, Tony.
I think that the word that really struck me when you were talking there was fear. Because if we are looking back over the last year, this is exactly this time last year, fear and the uncertain was permeating everywhere. It was not just here at the Analiffy, but everywhere, at all walks of life, in every home across the country. And you know, at one level, you had the narrative was that we should all stay at home to protect ourselves and to protect our loved ones and others and the community and such. And yet, you know, health workers in state agencies and in the NGOs were being asked to come in. And I think that can't be forgotten, and it can't be lost in when we talk about these things over the years to come. It was really scary for everybody. And as an employer, you were dealing with that. You were trying to help people. You were only human yourself as well. And when I say as an employer, I'm talking about me. I'm talking about our head of services, Dawn Russell. I'm talking about our team leaders and such. There was this sense of shared responsibility, shared leadership at the appropriate levels, right across the board, down to peer-to-peer team member leadership. You know, there was all hands to the pump. It was a phenomenal thing to observe. And I'm talking about Analiffy, but I saw that in other agencies too. And I think that was totally amazing and admirable, but it was also a challenge, you know, and people were frightened. We didn't have vaccines. Masks were on their way. We were gradually understanding what we needed to do to keep ourselves as safe as possible. We learned new language came into play, you know, around COVID, all sorts of things, shielding units, and, you know, we were learning about social distancing and all this sort of thing. So a lot of that was sort of getting to understand all that and explaining to people what we needed to do. So there was a lot of that going on. And I think it was just hugely challenging, and we could only do it together. We could only do it as a team. And I'm very proud of everybody for what they did and what they continue to do, because it hasn't stopped. We've just gone through the third wave, which was harder, I think, for us than the first and second wave again, because we've been, you know, already the team had been through two waves, and we came into the Christmas period and had to go into a third wave, which saw even higher numbers nationally. So, yeah, there was a lot of hard work being done in the last 12 months.
I think that's probably echoed right across society, isn't it? Yeah. That people are more frustrated maybe than they have been right now after a full year of restrictions and uncertainty and still no certainty around when this is actually going to end and what that means for people, whether they're working on the front line or whether they're, you know, back in their homes, remote working. Sure. I think it's hugely challenging. But I have noticed that there's far more frustration around, and it's been a long winter, hasn't it?
Yeah. I think it's really important to mention, you know, because I will talk about frontline work and such, but the amount of change we went through had a knock-on effect at the back end of the organisation as well, which has to be mentioned. And as you say, you can take Analytica as a microcosm of what's happening elsewhere. You know, like, I mean, it's not going to be exactly the same, but it's going to be very, very similar. So you've got a lot of agencies who've changed enormously. And all of that has knock-on effects for a HR perspective, finance perspective, health and safety perspective, and so on and so on. And there's just been an enormous amount of work done at the back end of organisations as well, in terms of writing policies, you know, whatever it might be. So it needs to be acknowledged. There's a lot of unsung heroes across every organisation now. It needs to be remembered, I guess.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, with the increase in demand on services such as the Analyfi drug project, like, many frontline workers have been having to work longer hours or more hours. And I'm really interested to know how employers have actually been managing this, like, especially if employees have been sick, suffering from burnout, perhaps even had COVID or needed to self-isolate. What do you think, Tony?
I think that it was... It was really challenging. Obviously, you were asking a lot of somebody to come in still, and people really rose to that challenge. Some people had concerns, and I spoke to them personally and such. And I think, you know, that was one example of transparent communication. I think that if all this change is going on, you've just got to be honest with people about why it's happening, what's being asked of the organisation, and in turn of them, and. That came to the fore. I think that if you look back at what we've just all gone through, I think organisations that had transparent communication and were completely honest with their team members did very well in terms of garnering support from team members and moving together into that change. But it was hugely difficult. Obviously, at the beginning, we certainly had some medically vulnerable staff, and we did facilitate them to work from home. But there was plenty of work for them to do, and we did that from March onwards for a number of months until we fully gradually understood more and things became a little bit safer in the summer and people came back into work. We had to ask people to do more hours. I think you mentioned a moment ago. Certainly at Analyfi, we had a policy of time off in lieu, but that only works so much, and there was so much more work to do. We went from 9:30 to 5:30 Monday to Friday to working, you know, 7 days a week, and you know, into the evenings and things. So, you know, we did have to begin to pay overtime and such. That's what we did because that's what people deserve for their time. And of course, there were other supports around annual leave. It was all. I think every organisation has experienced difficulty getting people to take annual leave because what are you going to do when you take annual leave? You're going to sit at the house. So you know, we need. But you know, it is important to take annual leave. It is important to manage that resource as an organisation as well, as well as for the individual. So obviously, we encourage people to take their leave and such. And there was other forms of leave that we had for people as well that would have been standard. I think the other kind of supports that we would have had were we provide external supports for staff. So people get a one-to-one every month. Managers were very, very busy, but I'm proud to say they were very accessible as well to reassure people. So that was great. And something that Mary mentioned there, we know we can't get together and, you know, give each other a hug or whatever, but we could get together on team meetings via Zoom and such, and we did. And that, again, was part of the sharing of information across the team. And, you know, when you haven't seen people, at least that had some value, had some great value in terms of seeing a face and talking to somebody when you haven't seen them. So that was really good, yeah.
And I suppose as we look to the future, many employers are kind of asking questions about vaccinations. I guess it's especially important for frontline workers who deal with vulnerable people as well. But it's becoming clear that employers can't really insist on immunisation. However, if it's critical for public safety or to protect others, do you think, Mary, do you think, is it reasonable for an employer to request that they do so?
It's a really complicated and complex situation, because I guess, you know, our health service haven't mandated it as, you know, something that people have to do just because they work within the health sector, and likewise all across of society. I don't think we can mandate that people become vaccinated, but yet there's a bit of a contradiction in terms, in that the employer is liable for the health, safety and well-being of the people that they bring into the workplace. And if some people are not vaccinated and others are, there is a conundrum for the employer. What is the employer to do? So there's quite a lot of talk out there about, you know, what an employer's responsibility is, but there's not a lot of clarity about what you do if somebody simply refuses to have a vaccination. And while you might be able to, you know, insert some kind of a clause into a contract of employment for new entrants into the workplace about vaccinations, and that's not tested yet through any court system, it's a challenge for existing staff when you're asking somebody to do something and they make a decision themselves that they don't want a vaccination. And I don't think, you know, obviously the news about AstraZeneca that has broken this week and you know, that it's temporarily suspended will be a cause for concern to people who might have been on the line about whether or not they would become vaccinated or not. I think the employer needs to take into consideration a number of factors, one being health. You know, are there underlying reasons why an individual doesn't get a vaccine? Has a doctor recommended that they don't get a vaccine? You've got religion, culture. There's a whole load of things that we need to factor in here when we look at this whole area. But fundamentally, when you're providing frontline services, you're dealing with other people and vulnerable groups of people, and it becomes really difficult. And I believe also that insurance companies are specifying within their policies exclusions when it comes to COVID-19 in the workplace, which is going to have an impact on all sectors who deliver those kind of frontline services to vulnerable people. I don't know if you have a view, Tony, and it's not an easy one because...
Oh, yeah. No, I think we've asked our team of frontline workers that they're working on the subject of addiction. Something I haven't mentioned so far is our work with the HSC, particularly in Dublin, around COVID-19. And as a consequence, our team were vaccinated very early on because of the work they're doing in terms of transporting people for tests and other work around contact tracing and such. And everybody got the vaccine. And then again, down in Limerick more recently, everybody got the vaccine. And I think, you know, all we could do for anyone who had concerns was encourage and educate people. That's all we could do. But people did take it, so it didn't become any more of a live issue. Today, having gone through a process, a governance process here, we've inserted some language around the need to be vaccinated into new contracts for staff. Yeah, because I think we have to do something in that regard for new entrants.
Yeah, and I guess it'll be how that all plays out in court settings in the future when, you know, because do we exclude people from the workplace who aren't vaccinated? And that is an issue that right now as employers we don't really have to contend with because we've got such a large proportion of the population who aren't vaccinated as of yet. But I guess in the future we will see whether this is a bigger issue. Anecdotally, I'm hearing from some of our clients that there's probably somewhere between 10 and 20% of people within organizations who are saying no or not right now, or I'll wait for a different vaccine to become available and then I'll do it. I don't want to take this particular one. So I think, you know, like Tony said, and I think it's really sensible from an employer point of view, the sharing of information, the educating of the workforce, the listening to what people have to say and the understanding of their fears. People have the right to make these decisions themselves, but the employer still has to, you know, take into consideration people's individual wishes.
We would have encouraged people to go and speak to their own GP, you know, because obviously it's important for them to go and get, you know, as impartial advice as they can, and from a voice that they trust. So that was always a good start. Go and speak to your GP, and obviously we would give our opinion on the need to be vaccinated. But good to hear from your own GP too.
Yeah.
Guys, that's about all we have time for. So, Tony, just before we wrap up, I wanted to ask, what's the best way for people to get in touch to find out a little bit more about the work of Analyphi Drug Project?
Yeah, probably there's the aldp.ie, our website. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram. So, yeah, just look up at Analyphi and you'll find all weird and wonderful postings and photographs and things of our work and things there.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thanks to you both for joining us today.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR that helps you create the human resources systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, go to www.insighthr.ie/podcast. That's www.insighthr.ie/podcast. We'd love it if you subscribe, like, and share the show with any friends and colleagues who are looking for fresh ideas on how to create the ideal workplace for their business. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or an on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Thanks, and see you soon.